accession number 13670, reel 2.
Colonel Jones, reel 2.
He nodded to me, and I leapt out of the craft into water about waist deep, which was very rough. The result was that the next wave lifted up the assault craft, and it landed right on top of me and crushed me into the sand. I can remember, I'm quite a good swimmer, so I'm used to being in water, and I had my eyes open. I could see the water, the sand swilling about, and thought, well, this is a fine way to end up, drown before I even get ashore. But the helmsman turned the helm over, and I came up alongside the craft with most of my platoon peering down to see what had happened to me. So I waved them off, and we got up the shore, as I've described already. At one point that might amuse you was that I'd been suffering from impetigo, from a blanket which I must have had in the transit camp, and I was covered with gentian violet. This had been going on for several days. The next day it had all disappeared.
How frightening was it on landing?
I think we were green. We didn't really know what it was about. I was much more frightened subsequently in other things. I think we were seized by the excitement of the moment, rushed up the beach. I think perhaps had we been more experienced, we might have tried to dig in at the top of the beach. As it was, we wanted to get clear and inland. I think the fact that we were inexperienced was, in fact, to our advantage at that time.
How fast could you run with all the equipment that you had to carry?
We were young and fit, and we'd done a lot of training quite fast, and the sand was fortunately firm and hard.
Were you taking much notice about what was happening elsewhere on the beach round about you?
Not really. I can remember noticing that Bob Pierce's platoon on my right was slightly ahead of me and moving up the beach. And I also noted that there were no DD tanks about, which we had expected. And I couldn't see anything on our left where I expected to see 9 Platoon Headquarter Company. And we know now, of course, that they had drifted much further to the left than they should have done.
What did you feel about the performance of the men in your unit on the landing?
Well, there was a very interesting experience there in man management. I'd got 3 section commanders, and 2 I remember clearly. One was a Liverpool policeman who was a bright lad, and I'd always found on exercises that he was very good. The other one was a regular soldier, and I thought, mistakenly obviously, that he was rather slow, because he always used to ask, or when you said any questions, he always used to ask some questions. I realised now he was only checking. And I said to the ex-policeman, we'll take our section into this building here, and the other 2 sections will give us covering fire. And there was no response. And I realised that he was completely shocked by the experience and couldn't take in what I was saying. And the other second commander came up to me and said, what are you asking to do, sir? So I said, go into this building. So he said to his section, come on. We all went into the building. Interesting lesson, as I say, in man management.
Did it surprise you that he was so shocked?
Yes, because we hadn't really experienced any serious small arms fire directed at us. There had been small arms fire. It didn't appear to be directed at us in particular. Nor had we suffered many casualties at that stage.
You mentioned those first German prisoners. What impression did they make on you close up?
Looking back, I wonder, actually, if they were Germans and whether they weren't rather, perhaps, Russians, Poles, or some other occupied troops who'd been more or less given the choice of concentration camp or being shot or joining the army. They didn't seem to put up a lot of serious resistance.
Was it that that made you think they were not Germans?
Well, I think looking back at the situation, that was one of the factors that made me reach that conclusion.
Did you put any kind of label on the cellar to indicate that they were in there?
No, we didn't have time to think about that. We thought having disarmed them and locked them in, that was the best we could do.
Now, you said that you described how you first came across your first casualty close up when that man was shot in the head. What reaction did you have to that, personally?
I think one was startled at first. You see, you get used having been in the butts when you're firing, when other troops are firing, to shots going close to you. So the actual noise was perhaps a little startling, but not entirely unusual. But the fact of being spattered with bits of brain and bone is a startling experience the first time it happens.
Did it disgust you in any way?
No. You see, the shot was a perfect shot. It went straight through his forehead and blew the whole of the back of his head out.
What were you carrying yourself?
Well, that was interesting because I had a Sten gun. For some reason, we had to give up our revolvers and we were given Sten guns. We're never quite sure about Sten guns because, as you've perhaps heard, they didn't always fire when you pressed the trigger. The working part went forward, but they didn't always fire. You couldn't rely absolutely on them. But we'd surrendered our pistol and we had a Sten gun. But when I was crushed under the craft, I lost my Sten gun. So I took a rifle from the first man to be wounded, and I had an ordinary Lee Enfield rifle with me.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you having finished your first day in France. How did you spend the night?
Well, I slept quite soundly in a slit trench. I imagine that the company commander had put the LOBs, who hadn't been in action, on guard duty. And we were there for a reasonably quiet night. And that brought me to the next day. And I had two tasks on the next day, and I can't remember which order they were. One was to go out with a jeep and collect a number of British dead lying just to our right forward flank. They were Norfolks from one of the other brigades. And then, as I had been in Lyon-sur-Mer, I was asked to meet the brigadier at the top of the church tower who was directing operations to clear what were left of the German troops that had been in Lyon-sur-Mer, and I met him there and told him what I knew about it. And he, with the assistance of, I think, our B Company and a couple of Avery's armed with petards, that's this huge mortar, cleared out the Germans there. The rest of them surrendered. And we learned that purely by coincidence, that particular position at Lyon-sur-Mer had been reinforced the night before by an additional company.
How had those Norfolks been killed?
Machine gun fire.
Then what happened to you next?
That was the rest of that day. Then on the 8th of June, we were ordered to go forward in support of the 6th Airborne, who were holding the bridges across the River Orne and were under some pressure from German troops. You remember that they had been landed in order to protect the left or east flank of our landing. And it was there that I was first strafed by an enemy aircraft. We'd seen very little of the German Air Force, or for that matter of our Air Force on D-Day, but we realised, of course, that they'd been operating much further inland, keeping the German aircraft away from the beach area. But on that occasion, we were strafed by aircraft, and it's quite amusing if you see a film of people being strafed by aircraft, they sort of run and leap into a slit trench. You don't get any time to do that. It's just over in a flash. You're either out of the way or not.
Can you describe how you made contact with the 6th Airborne?
Yes, they were dug in around there. There didn't seem to be a lot of them, and we just reinforced them and dug in around them and were there for only 24 hours, I think, when I presume other troops came up. I can't remember, but we were moved, first of all, to Matier, and then were ordered on the 10th of June to occupy a chateau called Le Londel, which was a mansion or chateau itself with a group of farm buildings round it and a certain amount of tree cover. And we were separated by the width of a wheat field, perhaps 150 yards, from a corresponding chateau called Lalonde. We were digging in at Lalondale, and German troops were obviously doing the same at the Chateau de Lalonde. What we didn't realise at the time, and pieced together subsequently, was that they were part of a defensive perimeter that the Germans were establishing to the north of Caen, having recovered from their surprise on D-Day. And A Company occupied a position to the right of a track which led from Le Londel to Chateau de Lalonde. There was an outbuilding there, which I gather subsequently had been the German officers' mess. And we were fortunate, an object lesson here. I gave positions for our troops to dig in forward of the farm building in the field, in slit trenches. And this was fortunate because a morning or two later, the Germans brought up some heavy self-propelled guns and shelled this farmhouse. And although it was built of huge slabs of Caen stone, they reduced it to rubble. Fortunately, as I say, we were in the field in front, and although we had a few casualties, not nearly as many as we would have had if we'd occupied the building itself. We did have some sort of compensation in the form of what was known as a victor salvo. Brigade headquarters was in wireless contact with HMS Rodney, and they could call upon HMS Rodney to fire a salvo or two. And that was quite an interesting experience. I don't know whether it was policy or just happened that way. They nearly always seemed to fire at night. We were told that the Victor salvo would be fired, and remember, we're talking about 15-inch guns firing at shells that weigh a ton. And the first thing you see would be a vivid flash out in the channel, rather like a lightning flash. And then there would be a rumble overhead, rather like a tube train coming out of the tunnel. And then you'd hear the explosion of the guns being fired in the channel. And then you'd wait. Seemed a very long time. Seemed like minutes before you'd then hear the explosion somewhere in the Caen area of the shells landing. We were relieved for a few days by the 2nd East Yorks, and we went to back to Mattier. I think it was there that we experienced the mobile bath unit. Very interesting experience this. It drew up on the side of an unsurfaced road, and it was a series of 3-ton vehicles with pipes leading from it, and nozzles, and a pretty thin trickle of water came from these. You got underneath and soaped yourself. And as vehicles were going along this road raising dust, you kept getting covered with dust. And just as we were standing there naked, the Germans started shelling. Amusingly enough, they were shelling the beach installation, so you could see the shells going over, but you felt particularly vulnerable standing there with nothing on. But I think one of the great advantages was they issued you with clean underpants at the same time, which is a great benefit. So we then returned, I think it was on the 21st, to our position at Le Londel.
Just before you take that up again, can I take this opportunity to ask you about living conditions in Normandy?
Yes, well, first of all, we were in slit trenches. Some we dug ourselves, some were German trenches that we had taken over. Food was good. Throughout the whole campaign, I can only remember two or three occasions when the quartermaster didn't get a hot meal up to the forward troops. We were able to shave in position. Going to the toilet was a bit more difficult. You had to take a spade or an entrenching tool and wait for a break in the shelling and mortaring. But we managed that. For something like several weeks, we would not be able to take our clothes or boots off. I think the point was that they had expected casualties in 3 Div to be much heavier than they were. They didn't expect, I think, 3 Div to be a fighting unit, but we were. And so we were kept in the front line for a long time in close proximity to the enemy. They were only a few hundred yards away from us. So not only were shelled or mortared, but you were also subject to small arms fire as well. Going round to check your platoon, moving from one slit trench to the next, you literally took your life in your hands every time you moved. And the only time you got a break was when, as I say, you were relieved and you went back, perhaps only a couple of miles, but it made all that much difference. Has that more or less answered your question, or had you?
Yes, did you suffer from any insect life, like lice or fleas or mosquitoes?
No, mosquitoes came later. I'll tell you about those when we come to another aspect of the campaign. If you remember, we'd had stormy weather, but the weather had improved there, and it was sunny. Apart from the unpleasant of shelling and so on, you might just as well have been camping out.
When you made contacts with these other units, like 6th Airborne and 2nd East Yorks, what impression did you get about their conditioners compared with your own unit?
They were picked troops, and I think they were possibly more professional than we were. They had specific training for a specific job, and they were hand-picked. They were all volunteers, compared with ours, who were ordinary, average British citizens.
You're talking about 6th Airborne, then?
6th Airborne, yes. They were.
What about the 2nd East Yorks?
Well, 2nd East Yorks were very much like ourselves. You've got to remember, of course, that, again, we didn't know at the time, that the British Army was scraping the barrel for infantry. We were getting very short of infantry, certainly by the end of the campaign, near the beginning then. So replacements were not as well-trained or of good quality as the original battalion, particularly in the question of NCOs.
Not as good quality in what way?
They weren't as well-trained and they weren't physically as robust. And remember that a lot of the NCOs, as I say, were long-time serving regular soldiers. So once you lost those, you lost a lot of experience.
Did the East Yorkshire seem to have suffered as much as your unit?
I think probably overall they'd suffered rather more than we had. They had a very difficult position. Not only had they had to assist us in clearing this strong point Cod, but they'd had the this very strongly fortified ferro-concrete position to deal with. I think it was called Daimler code word, wasn't it? It was, I think, the local commander's headquarters with, I think, anti-tank guns as well as machine guns in it.
Now, you were just about to rejoin the front line.
Yes, we went back to relieve the East Yorks. And previously and during this period, we did a number of patrols into the Lalonde position. I did two or three myself, and other officers and sergeants similarly. These were night patrols. And we kept bringing back reports of enemy tanks in this position. But nobody seemed to be particularly concerned about this or take particular notice. I can remember being asked to identify them, and I had difficulty because, of course, it was dark, but I decided they were probably Mark IVs rather than either Panthers or Tigers. Anyway, on that night that we went, that's the night of the 21st, 22nd, the battalion staged a silent attack with B Company right and C Company left. C Company were held up, but B Company occupied the orchard on the right of the Chateau of Lalonde. And I was ordered, just as it was getting light, to go forward with my platoon and reinforce them. I marched my platoon down the track which led from Lalondel to Chateau de Lalonde, entered the trees and orchard, and established my platoon in some sit trenches already dug there, presumably by the Germans, and walked forward a few yards to meet B Company commander, a Captain Murison, who was himself walking back to meet me. And we just contacted and said good morning when there was a tremendous outburst of firing and shelling, and he rushed forward to his company and I rushed back to 8th Platoon. And the Germans launched a very fierce counterattack with tanks and overwhelmed B Company. I think we were fortunate with 8th Platoon in that the trees were a little large and thicker where we were, and we were able to hold our own. And in fact, we stayed there in that position for three very uncomfortable days. Comfortable because, of course, the Germans knew the position. They had snipers and were able to pick off odd individuals if there was any movement. And they kept shelling and mortaring the position. But it was useful to our battalion to have this forward position because they could use it as a patrol firm base. Now here again we were unfortunate. The position of my slit trench was alongside the track which I've described that ran from Le Landol to Châtelet-Olon. And one night a sergeant that I knew quite well, I think his name was Ratcliffe, from D Company, and remember I had originally been in D Company, came along with a patrol, and I was standing in my slit trench. He was the other side of the hedge on the track, and we were carrying out a whispered conversation about the enemy position and so on before he moved forward, when the Germans opened up with an artillery salvo, and Sergeant Ratcliffe is a patrol, were literally blown to pieces. It was very unfortunate. On the 26th, we got orders to withdraw before dawn from this position, and we came back, and I have described that A Company were to the right of this track, and we joined them, and we'd had very little sleep and very little food, and they fed us, and they had some slit trenches with us, ready for us, and I literally fell into one of these and went immediately to sleep. And it seemed only a very short time afterwards when there seemed to be lights flashing and whistles blowing and so on, and I woke up, and the position was being shelled. And I thought at first that I had been hit because I couldn't move. And I put my elbows on the edge of it and levered myself up, and I realised what had happened was that I'd fallen into the slit trench and gone to sleep in such a cramped position that the blood had stopped flowing and my lower limbs were completely numb. And then the circulation started flowing again and I was all right. And what happened, what was happening was we were ordered to stand to because the Germans were shelling our positions and also putting in a counterattack on the position we'd just left a few hours before. So the brigade commander had decided that on the 27th, that was the next day, we should put in a daytime attack on the chateau, assisted by a troop of crocodiles. They are Churchill tanks with flamethrowers. And C and D Company were to advance first. C Company left and D Company right. And they set off, and orders then came through that the left hand of the attack was doing rather better than the right, and so I was to, or at least A Company was to reinforce them, and as I knew the area of controls, I was asked to lead